Emily. Call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 11th of May, and we have three public hearings scheduled, two work sessions, and we'll do the work sessions after we have a few Senate members here that are here to testify on a couple of public hearings. So we'll start out by opening up a public hearing on HJM 19. Senator Knope, that's your cue. And Beth, tell us real briefly what the bill does.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Joint Memorial 19 urges the Secretary of Energy and Congress to support the siting of the United States Department of Energy's Frontier Observatory for Research in Geothermal Energy at Newberry Geothermal Project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. State Senator Tim Knope from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And today I bring you HJM 19. This is a great memorial. Normally, I don't believe in that some of these things do a lot of good, but I believe in this particular case it's critically important, because what's at stake really is about $30 million annually and approximately 100 permanent jobs and probably 300 jobs to construct what would be the United States Department of Energy's Frontier Observatory for Research in Geothermal Energy, also known as FORGE, at the Newberry Geothermal Project location. And the purpose of the U.S. Department of Energy's FORGE is to perform advanced research on enhanced geothermal systems for the purpose of developing large-scale, economically sustained heat exchange systems. And this particular area is uniquely suited for that purpose. We're in competition with four other locations, including Utah, Idaho, California, and Nevada. And an advantage that Oregon has is that the proposed Oregon site would be located near the private Newberry Geothermal Project, which is already working and has been identified as one of the best sites in the country. And there are a lot of supporters of this particular project, including, I believe, the governor and Senator Merkley and Wyden, as well as Walden and many others. And so Idaho, I believe their legislature has passed a memorial that calls on the Department of Energy to award them the project, and we beg to differ. So we would love to have a very bipartisan vote on this, because it's good for Oregon. It would bring us not only some federal funds, but also obviously some jobs and income taxes to the state. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
All right. Questions? Senator Knope?
Senator, no emergency clause?
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, so this is a multi-year project. So we were actually we are in phase one, and we are one of five. And after a year, they will cut this down to three. And then after the second year, they will pick one. And so we probably can send this before it would take effect with an emergency clause. So we could actually email it as soon as it is approved.
Good. Follow up?
Yeah.
Do you have continuing plans to send more joint memorials to keep them abreast of what we're doing?
You know, I think we, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I think we should do whatever we can to keep them aware of the situation, whether that's memorials or just contacting legislators and people with the Department of Energy, because this really is. If this was based on merit alone, we're going to be the hands-down winner. But you might have guessed that there's going to be some politics involved in Washington, D.C., so we are hopeful that our delegation will be in a position of strength as it relates to that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for bringing this. I think it's sounds like it's a pretty good project. And while House Joint Memorial 19 may not be the deciding factor, the absence of legislative support may be the deciding factor.
That's
so
correct.
I do think this is a good piece of legislation. So thanks for bringing it.
Thank you.
Okay. Is anybody else here to actually no? Before, did we have anybody else signed up for that one?
No, sir.
Okay. We don't have anybody else signed up. So if there was anybody else that was signed up to testify on HJM 19, you could raise your hand. Okay, if not, okay, we're going to close the public hearing on HJM 19. That's not scheduled for a work session today, but expect that it will be soon. We are going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3329. Senator Whitsitt, that's your cue. Beth?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3329 would modify the standard for geothermal energy resources to qualify as a green energy technology if the water user as a heat source is more than 128 degrees Fahrenheit and the system is used for a public school building.
Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt representing Senate District 28, which is Klamath, Crook, most of Lake Jackson and Deschutes counties. House Bill 3329 has only one purpose. That purpose is to allow the Klamath County School District to use existing geothermal resources to reduce energy cost as well as to reduce the use of fossil fuels. The Klamath County School District is constructing a new elementary school at Henley. The district owns a geothermal well located on the school's property that flows at about 130 degrees Fahrenheit. The geothermal heat from that well is currently being used to space heat and to heat potable water for the Henley High School. The district started the high school project in 2004 and has since completed periodic energy efficiency upgrades. During the very cold winter of 2013-14, the high school complex was heated entirely by the geothermal system. That is, at least until the outside ambient temperature fell far below 0 degrees Fahrenheit. This existing system has been saving the district approximately $85,000 each year in natural gas costs. Total savings as well are well more than $500,000, well more than enough to keep an additional teacher on staff. The district now wants to use the geothermal well to space heat its elementary school building and to heat its potable water supply as well. The additional estimated savings at the elementary school will be about $40,000 each year. ORS 279.527 states that the green energy technology does not include a system that uses groundwater at temperatures less than 140 degrees Fahrenheit. Because the district's geothermal well flows at 130 degrees Fahrenheit, this provision of the existing statute prevents the district from using its geothermal well for the required green energy technology for the new elementary school building. House Bill 3329 amends that statute to allow the use of groundwater at 128 degrees Fahrenheit and above as green energy technology, but only if the system is used for a public school building. To our knowledge, Mr. Chair, no other existing or contemplated school construction projects fits this description. Enactment of House Bill 3329 will enable the Klamath County School District to annually save another $40,000 in energy costs by using its existing geothermal well to space heat and heat potable water in its new elementary school building. According to the district, the geothermal project will greatly reduce the use of natural gas. The act only applies to public improvement contracts that are first advertised or entered into on or after the effective date of this act, which is the 91st day after Sonny died. It applies only to this single school building. Mr. Chair, we urge the committee to unanimously approve House Bill 3329 and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Questions, Senator? No. Getting off easy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
It's not scheduled for a work session today, but I anticipate that it probably will be soon. So thanks for bringing this bill and your testimony. So is there anybody else that was signed up for House Bill 3329? I don't have anybody else signed up on the sheet. Okay, there are none, so we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3329. We're going to next we're going to have open up the work session on House Bill 3382. Then we're going to leave it the public hearing. Thank you. We're going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 3382, the canola bill. We're going to take Senator Gelser's testimony. We're going to leave that public hearing open, but we're going to open up then two work sessions, get through those quickly, and then move on with the all the folks that are here to testify on the canola bill. So with that explanation of our path forward, I'm opening up a public hearing on House Bill 3382. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Corvallis and Albany and surrounding areas. There's a copy of my testimony in OLIS for you. I was deeply concerned when I learned the existence of House Bill 3382 the night before it was on the House floor. In 2013, I spent much of my session focused on House Bill 2427, which related to canola. My district and the farmers in the surrounding district have been very clear to me for years that their thriving specialty seed industry is threatened by the introduction of canola into a long held protected district in that area. There were others that wanted to begin growing canola, and you may remember that the Department of Ag implemented some rules, and that discussion then came to the legislature. We worked very hard throughout the 2013 session to come up with a bill that was workable, and that bill did two things. One, it directed and funded Oregon State University to conduct a study on the impact of canola on brassicas in the Mid Valley, and it also put a 6-year moratorium on the introduction of commercial canola into the Willamette Valley. I'm deeply troubled by this House bill, House Bill 3382, because it proposes to plant 500 acres, up to 500 acres of commercial canola in this protected area before the study is even complete. This study that we spent over $1 million on, that we all agreed we were going to use the science to guide future policy related to canola in the valley, this just jumps the gun by putting that canola back in the valley before we even get the report on that study. Secondly, it violates that 6-year moratorium by suggesting that for the last 3 years of the 6-year moratorium, we allow commercial canola to be grown in the Willamette Valley. House Bill 2427 was passed in good faith. There were recommendations. There was a proposed amendment to allow up to 500 acres of canola, and that was rejected. It is inappropriate to come back in the immediate next session and undo the good work that was done. It makes it very difficult to negotiate on these difficult issues, and I would ask that you not move this bill forward, that you not open a work session, that we allow the science to be done, that we wait to get the study back. We've invested in it. It would be a waste of all of that money to put canola in the valley before we get the results of that study, and that we honor that 6-year moratorium and commit, as we did 2 years ago, that any future decisions about canola in that protected district be guided by the results of that study. I'm happy to answer any questions, but just one more time, unequivocally, I ask you on behalf of the family farmers and specialty seed farmers in my district, where it is a very important part of our economy, to please not move this bill forward.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Questions of the senator?
I have
one. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Gelser. The House bill you mentioned, 2427, was that of 2013?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
The concerns of your group there is the cross-pollination of the canola with their crops, correct?
That is correct.
Is it true that other brassicas can cross-pollinate with each other?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, yes, it is true that other brassicas can cross-pollinate. That's why the study is looking both at canola and at other brassicas, so that we can compare and also look at kind of infections and other issues for those crops. And that is the question that we wanted to have answered by the study.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony as one of your chief co-sponsors on the bill last session. I also share concerns. However, I agreed to hear this bill and hear out the proponents, and we'll go from there. So
great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. So we are going to leave this public hearing open. We're going to open up a couple of work sessions and get some work done, and then hear the rest of the testimony on this bill. So With that, committee members, we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2047. Beth.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2047 has a no revenue or a no fiscal impact statement issued on the measure. The measure itself would correct certain place names that were misidentified in the 2014 legislation that adjusted reserve boundaries and comprehensive planning maps adopted by Metro.
Yeah, so you'll remember, folks, this is the cleanup bill from the quote-unquote grand bargain of the last legislative session for Washington County. We didn't have any opposition to these amendments or this bill as it's written. Yeah, Senator Rosansky.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, what I took away and what you're saying is this is kind of a Scrivener's error bill where we're just going in and fixing some things that were mis-ID'd and flip-flopping one location to another that was misstated in the text or something.
That is also the way that I understand it. I did not go word for word and compare it to maps,
right.
But all the people that have gone word for word and compared it to maps said that they identified this error in the original bill in the February session as soon as they passed it, and they knew that they needed to come back this session and correct those errors. And I think everybody that was in agreement with the bargain of the last short legislative session is in agreement with this bill. So, okay, Senator Olson, you have a motion for me?
I do. And Chair Edwards, I move House Bill 2047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2047 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And let's see. Oh, yeah, we do need to sign a carry for this one. Let's see. Was anybody here involved with the Washington County one? Okay. I'll carry the bill on the Senate floor. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2047, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2400.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2400A has a no revenue, no fiscal impact statement issued on the bill. The bill would deem certain reports submitted by task forces created by Senate Bill 839 from 2013 as satisfying reporting requirements and retroactively extend repeal date and ratify and inform task force action since the original repeal date. We heard this bill on 5-4.
Yeah, so we heard this bill just, I guess that was last week. We had a number of questions. From what I've heard, people seem to have had their questions answered satisfactorily, so I think it's ready to go.
I would, Mr. Chair, I'd just make a comment that it does concern me when we task people to put together a group, a task force, and they don't comply and they don't get done. That concerns me that we have to write a bill to come back and fix what they can't get done. I understand the reasons for this, understand why it happened. I would just hope that this is not precedent setting so that we're always retroactively fixing things.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate your concerns.
I don't think it's a unique precedent setting. It has a grand tradition.
Exactly.
I think you're probably quite astute in that observation. Great. Okay, how about a motion?
Chair Edwards, I move House Bill 2400A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved House Bill 2400A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Are there any objections? Okay, note for the record the objection of Senator Thompson, and the motion carries. And I will carry this bill as well. We will now close the work session on House Bill 2400A. And we will go back to the public hearing, which we still have open, on House Bill 3382. And so let me start going through the witness list here. Let's start out with Jana Jarvis and Kathy Hadley. Next up will be, after this panel, we'll have, let's see. Oh, these are four. Okay. So Next, after this panel, we will do Ivan Molesky, Charles Ortiz, and Nick Titchen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jana Jarvis, here today on behalf of the Willamette Valley Oilseed Producers Association. I did submit some written testimony to you, but rather than go over that, I thought it might be more important for me to talk and give you a little brief overview on this particular issue. Obviously, canola production in the valley has been a contentious issue for a number of years. Interestingly enough, I first became aware of it when I came to the House Bill 2427 hearing in the 2013 session on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. The Oregon Wheat Commission has regulatory oversight of canola, of all oilseed production in the state. And the growers were typically not in favor of limits on particular crop choices. And after that, the Willamette Valley Oilseed Producers asked me to represent them on this issue. Just a little quick history. Canola was grown unrestricted in the 80s and 90s, but controversy grew over this crop, and a protected district was created in 2005 that did not allow production of canola in the Willamette Valley. Interestingly enough, Oregon State has studied canola as a viable rotation crop, particularly for dryland producers. And many of the ag experiment stations continue to promote canola and the soil-enhancing benefits of using it as a rotation crop. In fact, when I've been to field days over in Pendleton, they can't promote canola enough for an alternative in crop rotation for wheat and other grasses. In the Willamette Valley, however, canola has developed a negative reputation from a variety of misinformation campaigns, and production of canola was eventually banned in 2005. It had been grown prior to that in this region for a variety of purposes. Originally, it was thought to be a great source for biofuel production, but demand for canola has grown as it's been determined to be a heart-healthy oil, and demand for the food-grade production has increased dramatically in recent years. Canola is a member of the Brassicaceae family, and it shares genetic characteristics with a number of other crops, such as turnips and radishes, that are currently grown unrestricted in this region. These other Brassicaceae crops, however, are grown for seed, and control of this production is determined by the seed companies contracting for this production. In recent years, thousands of acres of brassicas have been grown for seed in the valley. Canola, however, is a commodity crop, doesn't need to be contracted with seed companies locally for production purposes. Because of the growing demand, the price of canola has grown to make it a highly desirable crop, particularly in the dryland portions of the valley where there isn't irrigation and crop choices are fewer. Controversy over canola production, particularly with the select seed companies, drove ODA to search for a compromise. In 2012, they proposed limited production of up to 2,500 acres along the perimeter of the valley, where the lack of irrigation and choices of crops were fewer. Their compromise led the seed companies to request House Bill 2427 in the 2013 session that sought to ban canola entirely. Instead, you and the legislature funded a study on this issue. It wasn't $1 million study. It was a $679,000 three-year study to see if canola presents the pest and disease issues that were claimed by many. House Bill 2427 enacted a six-year ban with a three-year study. Results of this study are due to you in the legislature in November of 2017, yet the ban exists through 2019. It should be noted that WVOPA was not consulted on this as this bill was amended. Much has been said about this carefully crafted legislation, yet the proponents of growing canola were not included in the discussion. But this is a local issue here in the valley. Currently, the 500 acres of production are being crushed in Rickreol, and the oil and canola meal resulting from this are being sold as animal feed to the dairy industry in Oregon. Interestingly enough, just as a side note, canola meal can increase production in a milk cow by 1 liter a day and greatly increase the quality of the milk. So production in-state adds value and jobs. There's much misinformation surrounding canola, and you'll hear others speak to this. You'll hear that this was carefully crafted legislation, but I already informed you that we weren't included in the discussion. You'll hear that the production of canola in the valley is a GE variety, but the producers here have chosen to grow conventional canola, and you'll hear why. You'll hear that canola presents different issues in seed scatter, pest and disease, herbicide resistance, etc., than other brassicas grown in the valley. I would ask you to refer to OSU on these issues, where their preliminary results indicate that canola presents no unique challenges here. WVOPA's request to you in House Bill 3382 is simply that you allow this limited production of up to 500 acres to continue for the balance of the moratorium. That allows the study results in 2017 to be considered by ODA and the legislature, and for you to use this as an example of voluntary coexistence. Canola is a highly desirable, profitable crop that has soil-enriching properties for this region, and we ask for your support of House Bill 3382. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenna. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Hadley, and I'm here today to encourage you to support House Bill 3382. I help run two different diversified crop and livestock farms with my dad, Dean Freeborn, in Rickreall, and my husband, Troy, in Silverton. Raise a variety of crops, including fescue, ryegrass, wheat, oats, peas, hay, oilseeds, and other brassica crops, and also some cattle. I've been interested in canola about 15 years now. Part of my master's of ag at OSU dealt with a research project about canola. We also participated in 08 and 09 in the research trials on our Rickreall farm. And we also extensively participated in the ODA advisory committees starting in 2005 when the WVSSA requested the department restrict canola in the valley. Prior to that, the only regulations on canola in the valley was to separate the edible and the inedible forms of rapeseed, of which canola is part of that family. In 2012, I helped a group of growers, including myself, form the WVOPA that Aunt Jana spoke to organize the growers that were interested in canola, and we are very glad to be participating in the trials again this current time. House Bill 3382 would allow us to continue growing 500 acres of canola in years 4 through 6 of the current moratorium. This bill would not impact completion of the current research project, and I really support and appreciate all the work that OSU's done. I've been very happy working with them, so I would not support something that interrupted those efforts or that negated the work of this body in 2013. The additional 500 acres would be under the management of the Department of Ag and OSU, so it would not just be a free-for-all or unrestricted. And also, the bill would not impact canola policy or acreage after 2019 because the moratorium was set to expire then anyway. So something else would have had to happen with ODA or another legislative action then. So this bill itself is not going to impact that or change that in any way. Canola has become a very valuable rotation on both of our farms, which are both dry land. We have no irrigation, so we're a lot more limited in our crop choices, especially for profitable rotation crops to grow with our grass seed. Canola is able to thrive in the dry land situations, just the fall and winter moisture, and we haven't had to invest any additional dollars into equipment to harvest it. As I mentioned, traditionally our focus has been grass seed. Having a broadleaf rotation crop like canola really allows us to utilize different chemicals and techniques to keep grass weeds out of those grass species. The alternative, you know, is trying to control a grass weed in a grass crop, and that doesn't work very well for a lot of reasons. Also, canola doesn't have hard seed like a lot of other brassicas, so it's easy to control as a volunteer. OSU will be reporting on this as part of their research. They had a trial in my field from last year, this fall, that's currently in ryegrass, and it was pretty easy to show that volunteers were no problem to control with normal management practices for grass species. The biggest reason I'm here advocating for canola, though, is we can make good money growing it. Our net returns on the canola exceeded those from our wheat fields, spring grains and legumes, and even several of our grass seed fields. Strong and increasing demand for canola as a heart-healthy oil, as Jana mentioned, has really driven demand both domestically and internationally, and that's bolstered market prices, and I firmly expect those to continue. We can market this at any point, unlike the other proprietary crops that are all grown under contract. Because canola falls under the statutes related to grain in this state, we have to be paid in 30 days. So I had a check for it last August versus like the forage brassica that I harvested last summer and didn't get paid for until last month. So on a cash flow basis, that's pretty important too. Also, as Jana mentioned, we're raising non-GMO varieties. Our yields in Rickrail with the non-GMO varieties were over 4,000 pounds to the acre, which is more than double the yields in eastern Oregon, Canada, the Midwest, typically. And our focus has been and will continue to be those non-GMO hybrids and conventional varieties because of those yields. And also, you know, we recognize there's issues and concerns with potential cross-pollination with some of the weedy species, and we don't need to grow them, so, you know, that's something we're happy to do to help negate that concern. Our Sillerton farm is up near Silver Creek Falls State Park, about 1,000 feet, and we're very limited up there with crop rotations with little topsoil. We've historically grown fine fescue. Even with all that, canola performed very well last year, and actually we ended up netting twice as much on it as we did on our fine fescue last year when we penciled everything out, and that was with record prices for the fine fescue and very average yields. So needless to say, we're very happy with it over there. You know, overall, canola has received a lot of negative publicity in the valley here. A lot of that's focused around the cross-pollination and isolation issues. I really feel that topic has been exaggerated. We raise 16 different varieties of fescue on our farm, and all of those require adequate isolation to maintain their registered or certified status through Oregon State and the seed certification system. We also have raised brassica crops and pinned them for the last 10 plus years. So I'm very familiar with that process, and there's no reason canola cannot be managed and isolated just like other crops are. This year, our canola fields are also actually involved with WVSSA encroachment agreements with two separate member companies. One of those companies focuses on specialty brassica seeds for forages, and the other raises vegetable seeds. And basically what that means is they signed agreements saying that they were willing to be within 3 miles of our canola because they didn't have a problem with that for those particular seed fields they were raising. So at least what that says to me, at least some of the WVSSA member companies are not only open to coexistence but willing to have their fields closer than their association stipulates. Another topic that, you know we'll talk about more today, but is the blackleg issue. And, you know, blackleg's been here for decades. ODA records can attest to that. As canola growers, we planted seed that was certified. It was tested free of blackleg and also treated preventatively. It is definitely susceptible, though, and we have been treating our canola with fungicide applications preventatively and to manage what is there as any prudent grower would. We make similar applications to our wheat to manage septorian stripe rust, to grass seed to manage rust. You know, it's kind of a fact of life in Western Oregon managing disease in the valley. I'm not trying to take this issue lightly. Blackleg is significant, but it's also nothing unique to canola or brassicaceae species. And finally, I just want to sum up saying that there's been a lot of talk this session about voluntary coexistence. Canola is just another example of a crop that can be managed and grown with cooperation and collaborative efforts between neighbors. And I would ask you to please support House Bill 3382 and allow us to continue growing this limited acreage. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you both. Questions? I have, go ahead, Senator Thompson.
Well, the agreement that came up with last session, we're going to do the Oregon State's going to do a study and last for the study's going to go for 3 years, and then what if the study says no more canola? Then with this bill, do you get to keep growing canola, or do you have to answer to the study?
Well, Senator Edwards and Senator Thompson, I guess I would say that, looking at the preliminary, testimony from Oregon State and kind of what they're saying is not seeing anything unique, my assumption would be if this bill passed, we would raise the 500 acres for 3 more years. And then after 2019, when the moratorium period expires, then it would be up for some other sort of action. If something did come up in the meantime that they haven't seen thus far, I guess it would be my assumption that this body could then address that at that point.
And I think in fairness, the bill said that, not the agreement. There wasn't an agreement.
Okay, but the bill.
We passed the bill in fairness to
canola growers. On the reverse of that, what if the study comes out and says, you can grow all the canola you want, are you stuck with 500 acres a year?
Senator Edwards, Senator Thompson, only until the end of this moratorium.
Right.
Yeah, if you pass this bill, we'd be allowed to grow up to 500 acres through that 6 years, and then there would have to be action taken after that to determine how much canola production could be in existence in the valley. And that would require either some kind of legislative action, some action on the part of ODA, or no action at all. I mean, those are the choices.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, if I may add, Senator Edwards and Senator Thompson, as I mentioned earlier, as a prudent grower, there is a limit on the number of brassicas that you want to be grown in this valley, because there are disease issues that need to be paid attention to. And there's reasons there are rules put in place about growing canola like 2 out of every 5 years and things like that, because there are concerns. And anyone, I don't care who you are, anyone that's growing a brassica needs to pay attention to those. So there is always going to be some limit. It's not, we will never see wall-to-wall canola.
But canola is just one of the brassicas.
Yeah, maybe you could say something about the timing issue or the seasonal issue. I mean, I think the common sense way to approach this would be, as the senator was implying, we have a study. Let's see what the study says. Either lift the moratorium or, extend the moratorium, depending on what advice we're getting from the study. Why pass this bill now as opposed to just waiting until we hear the results of the study?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro. The study results, as I mentioned to you, are due in November of 2017, and yet production of canola, even if they determine there are no issues and wanted to lift the moratorium, wouldn't happen until 2019. So there's 3 years of restricted growth. The crusher is up in processing. The dairies are buying the meal and the oil, and the market is open here. And until we determine that there's, for some reason, that we need to not have canola in the valley. The concern was you get the market open, you shut it down, then try to get it open again.
And could I just follow up? And in terms of the economic impact of the facility that's processing it, I mean, how many jobs, what sort of revenues are we looking at there?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, there's a gentleman here on behalf of the crusher that you can ask that question to, and he'd probably be better able to answer it than I am.
Okay, thank you.
Could you speak a little bit to, you mentioned food grade canola. How much of it would be considered food grade and how much of it would be non-food grade? And could you talk a little bit more about the different uses?
Yeah, so Senator Edwards, again, kind of to echo what Jana just said, the gentleman that's here from the crusher could extrapolate probably on what I will say, but my understanding based on where the markets are right now is it would all be going to food grade. It's worth significantly more, particularly being able to market this as non-GMO, because aside from the politics of the GMO issue, there are a lot of companies that want to be able to use non-GMO products and market them that way. So it does have a higher value just because of that.
And that's what you're growing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for these folks? Thank you. Right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm changing my order here just a little bit. I had said Ivan would be with this next panel. I'm going to actually have him go a little bit later, Ivan, if you could. But we do have Charles Ortiz, Nick Titchen, and Courtney Johnston. And then up next will be Thomas Endicott, Scott Setner. I can't read the. Okay, Setniker. Okay, and Anna Scharf.
I'm gonna go first. Hi, Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson. For the record, Courtney Johnston. I'm here today representing the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Let these gentlemen, they're the experts on how this works, and so I'm going to let them go. But I wanted to give a little bit of background here today. The Lehigh Valley Specialty Seed Association is made up of several companies involved in vegetable and specialty seed production here in the Willamette Valley. And, you know, because of the ideal climate here, Oregon's Willamette Valley is one of the five remaining regions in the world where vegetable seeds can be commercially grown. It produces over 90% of the world's European cabbage, Brussels sprouts, rutabaga, and turnip seeds. The region's specialty seed industry is valued at about $50 million annually to the canola industry's estimated But as you've heard today, canola has been restricted in the Willamette Valley for several decades now. And it's important to note that this decision was made after substantial research and community dialogue. And in fact, in 2005, after OSU conducted additional research studies, they concluded that due to the potential risk, precautions suggested not allowing canola production at this time. When they came back in 2012 and the Oregon Department of Agriculture looked to enact several new rules, several specialty seed companies threatened to pull their seed contracts from the Willamette Valley. In 2013, this body heard testimony from, I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but a seed company in Japan, which testified that if canola production is allowed, his company and other companies would immediately start looking for other places to produce their seeds. Countries with similar conditions to the Willamette Valley, like France, have seen their seed production industry decline because they allowed canola to be planted and thus affect the purity of their seeds. Canola farming has significantly harmed many other seed-growing regions, leaving the world with only a handful of locations remaining that seed development for the seed development and cultivation. And the Willamette Valley is one of them. And when the 2012 study was put together, that allowed for 500 acres to be grown for the purpose of research to help this study. This additional 500 acres that they're asking for here today it's not necessary for the study to play out the way we intended it to, the way you guys intended it to, the way the bill was passed last time. And it does significantly change what we've put in place and what you guys put in place to see help inform how to move forward on this issue. This has been contentious. It's been contentious in the past. And I think what we are just asking for you here today is to let the OSU finish their research as intended and let the Willamette Valley continue to be a world leader in specialty seeds. I'll let them go ahead and talk about why.
All right. Well, Senator Edwards, Senators, my name is Nick Titchenan. I'm the president of Universal Seed Company located in Independence, Oregon. We are a multinational vegetable seed production company. We produce seeds that are at the foundation of the vegetable seed trade for the entire world. I'm also the owner and operator of Sunnyview Red Barn LLC, which is a diversified farming operation in Salem. And I'm a member of the WVSSA and past president. I'll keep my testimony brief. We've already been through this just 2 years ago. You've heard all the arguments on both sides of this, and I think they're essentially unchanged. I wanted to just address a couple of comments that were made. It's been stated a few times already that the study results will be known in 2017. That's not entirely correct. The study will be completed for the purposes of the literature review and what they find in the immediate study. The reason there are three more years of moratorium is that they were going to continue the study for 3 years to see about the volunteer and rotation issue. So, in fact, that's why there's a six-year study. The other thing is it was stated that canola was never regulated in 2005. That's also incorrect. Canola has been regulated by the Oregon Department of Agriculture since 1989. So I just want to address those two issues. As you guys know, the legislature passed House Bill 2427 in 2013 to address various issues surrounding the conflict between the production of oilseed canola and the longstanding brassica seed and fresh market brassica industries in the Willamette Valley, meaning fresh market growers, cannery growers. As part of this legislation, funds were provided for OSU to undertake a six-year study to determine, amongst other things, the possible pest and disease impacts of broadacre canola production on the aforementioned crops. There's been no material change in the agronomic concerns that prompted that legislation 2 years ago, and the study is not complete. As such, it's difficult to justify this proposed bill that will preempt prior legislation and presuppose to know the results of the study currently underway. The acres of commercial canola production allowed during the study period were capped for specific reasons of preventing the proliferation of the crop during the study period. House Bill 3382 specifically calls for the allowance of commercial production of canola outside the study during the period is currently specifically restricted. The proponents of House Bill 3382 are making a market-based argument as a basis for their bill. It has been stated that the legislature does not make market-based decisions. It would be seem that in considering House Bill 3382, the legislature would be, by definition, making a market-based legislation decision. The only change since the inception of the current study is that the Willamette Valley is now in the midst of a major brassica disease outbreak, blackleg, that threatens the continued viability of all brassica production in the valley, including canola. This does not seem like a prudent time to reverse legislation and the study currently underway. House Bill 3382 is a piece of legislation that is narrowly crafted to benefit a few selected farmers to the likely detriment of their neighbor farmers. It's unnecessary and should be rejected. The study currently underway should be completed without modification, and upon the conclusion of the study is the time for this issue to be reexamined, not now. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Charles Ortiz. I'm the vice president of the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, and I've been an agronomist and farmer in the Willamette Valley for 22 years. The WVSSA has a long history of seeking purity among numerous specialty seed crops in the Willamette Valley, purity that includes but is not limited to genetics, weeds, and diseases. This includes all members of the crucifer group, Brassicaceae, such as radish and the many species found in the Brassica genus, including cabbage and its relatives, as well as canola and rapeseed. Among the plants in the crucifer family, canola is recognized as being unique because of its oilseed properties for industrial, edible, and in more recent times, biofuel use. In other words, for its non-seed growing applications. The potential for industrial canola or rapeseed to contaminate or poison edible canola was a primary reason for the ODA, Oregon Department of Agriculture, to establish control areas beginning in 1990. The potential for contamination could occur both mechanically, like mixed lots in a seed cleaner warehouse or something of that nature, and through cross-pollination. The foundation of the ODA rules was in recognition of canola and rapeseed's ability to cross-pollinate with each other and other brassica species and contaminate those related crops. The creation of these production control areas and the exclusion of canola rapeseed by ODA in 1990 for these purposes are very similar to rules in neighboring states that also keep the production of canola rapeseed excluded from production districts for brassica seed crops. In fact, the state of Oregon has an exclusion zone in Malheur County at the request of Idaho to protect its turnip growing regions. The ODA adopted rules that also included protection of seed crops of related species based on pest and disease considerations. In 2010, ODA summarized those considerations, including the unique character of the Willamette Valley for specialty seed production, the appropriate use of the ODA's control district authority as it relates to pests and diseases and other considerations, the number of fresh vegetable operations, including small farm operations, whose markets include local buyers, all of which could be negatively impacted by canola pests and diseases, the opportunity to grow canola in other regions in Oregon. These considerations remain and have not changed. Numerous reviews and adjustments to the rules were made until an impasse developed between the WVSSA and ODA early in 2013 and legislation ensued. At that time, ODA loosened some of the restrictive rules related to the Willamette Valley, which had been largely a control district that excluded canola. That exclusion existed in various forms for over 20 years and supported a large expansion of world-renowned crucifer seed production, an exclusion that originated in state government based upon the aforementioned reasons. The 2013 legislation was to set up guidelines and funds for research to address the short and long-term effects of growing canola in the same district or control areas with canola grown for seed and other specialty seeds. Canola, with its much higher tolerance for genetic impurity because of the coexistence challenges that may be introduced by it, warranted more study. The purpose of the research was to perform the following tasks. One, determine the compatibility of canola with other similar brassica crops and under what conditions it might be able to be grown. Two, review of available literature and other published materials regarding canola and its compatibility and unique challenges it may pose. Three, a map of the areas where canola might be able to be grown if coexistence is possible. 4, monitoring must include disease and insects and subsequent monitoring for volunteer plants. Number 5, all research must be peer-reviewed. These tasks aren't complete. The WVSSA operates on the principle of voluntary coexistence. But to have coexistence, you must have guidelines upon which to coexist. To develop these guidelines, you must decide if coexistence is first possible, and then under what scale and under what provisions it would be possible. These should be based upon rational and well-founded data, the whole purpose of the study. In conclusion, I'd say that HB House Bill 3382 would extend not only the sunset date, but would also, I believe, allow the unwarranted production of 3 more growing cycles of canola. House Bill 2427 was enacted to help solve the question of coexistence and compatibility between canola and specialty seed brassicas in the Willamette Valley Production District. These questions have not been answered, and until there are, no expansion of canola production is warranted. I have not heard in any of the testimony supplied by the proponents how or why an expansion of this production for the extra 3 years is necessary for the research component of House Bill 2427, under which the original 3 500-acre allotments were authorized. The argument of the WVSSA today is that House Bill 2427 set in motion a plan for comprehensive research and reporting. House Bill 2427 was based on a 6-year plan, and the outcome of the research is not yet known. WVSSA would argue that we should not make premature assumptions until the tasks from House Bill 2427 are completed. And that's why we oppose House Bill 3382, and we ask you to join us in that opposition. Thank you.
Thank you each for your testimony. Questions of the panel? I guess my only question would be, so it was mentioned that in the 2013 legislative session or prior to the 2013 legislative session, there had been foreign customers that had said, well, if you allow canola in the valley, we're going to cancel our contracts. Why is that? Is that because of the potential for that to be GE canola, or is that just because, is it because of other issues? Could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. I can answer that because I'm a guy who hears it quite a lot. There is a unfortunate historical precedent in other parts of the world, specifically Italy, France, and the British Isles, where there was once a thriving specialty seed industry, and it pretty much no longer exists. And we here in the Willamette Valley have actually been the fortunate recipients of the demise of those production areas elsewhere. Not to prejudice the outcome of the study, but there is a precedent for the inability of broadacre canola production to successfully coexist with specialty seed production due to a combination of pest and disease issues, specifically blackleg, which we'll be referring to here shortly, something called the Millichet pollen beetle, and lastly, physical seed contamination. And therefore, the warning shot that we receive from our customers is, well, if the area is going to be contaminated with canola and we run the risk of outcrossing disease issues, then we'll simply move down the road and try to find someplace else. The unfortunate reality of that is that there are not a lot of places left in the world to do this. So that's the basis for the concern.
Okay, thank you.
Can I make one additional comment? I just want to speak to the study for a second. It just got started, and there was some previous panelist said something about volunteer crops, and they can tell that they can account for volunteer crops, and they can see that. A 2012 study in California found that thousands of volunteer canola plants resulted from dormant canola seeds planted 4 years prior, and they found that testing had shown that the escape seeds can have a 7-year lifespan. So, I mean, it does take some time, which was part of the reason why the study is as long as it is, to sort of account for what can happen in that time period. Just want to get that on the record.
Okay. Any other questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you, H.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to invite the next panel that I called to come forward. But in the meantime, we have learned that the OSU professor who is traveling that couldn't be here today, she is available right now on the telephone. So we're going to call her.
She's answering her.
Okay. So she's being called right now. And then so you can wait or you're welcome to come up. But after, what's her name?
Dr.
Carol Mallory Smith. And then we will have Thomas Endicott, Scott Setnicker, and Anna Scharf. Maybe not. Thomas Endicott, Scott Setnicker, and Anna Scharf want to come forward. And then after this panel, we'll try Dr. Mallory Smith again.
Chair Edwards, member of the committee, my name is Thomas Endicott. I'm Vice President of Business Development for Willamette Biomass Processors, 1055 South Pacific Highway West in Rickreol. We are the only commercial oilseed crush facility in Oregon. We began operation in 2008. We've invested about $2.5 million in a previously mothballed wheat storage facility in Rickreol with good rail and truck access. We've created about 10 new full-time jobs with benefits. We're also organic certified through Oregon Tilth. We process organic and conventional crops, soybeans, canola, camelina, and flax. And by virtue of being organic certified, we only process non-GMO conventional crops. We can't do GE crops in our facility. We support HB 3382 to allow the extra 500 acres through 2019. We purchased all the canola that was produced here in the valley last year. We processed that seed into canola meal and canola oil. The canola meal went to dairy operations and chicken operations here in Oregon. And the canola oil went to those similar operations also. It was a feed grade canola oil because we do not refine the oil in our facility today. And I can speak to that a little more at the end here. I wish Dr. Smith, Mallory Smith would have been on the phone, but when we get her on the phone, I think she'll repeat what she said to the House committee, which is there's nothing unique about canola. It's a brassica crop. It's large acreage like turnip and radish. And quite frankly, I wish that we had a market for turnip oil and radish oil because I would have loved to have crushed the 15,000 acres of radish that was grown unregulated in the Willamette Valley last year and the 4,000 to 5,000 acres of turnip seed that was grown unregulated in the Willamette Valley last year. I asked a scientist at one conference how are canola and turnip related. I said, are they cousins? You know, is it that sort of relationship? And they said, really more like twins. So here we have twin crops, one unregulated completely, and canola that's been squashed here since 2005. So I think this is a reasonable request. If we could rely on a reasonable volume of canola, we would consider investing in food grade refining at our facility. It would require probably another $1 to $2 million worth of investment, and it would require something like maybe 3,000 to 5,000 acres total. So maybe that's available in the future, maybe not, but that's what it would take for us to go food grade, and that would probably add another 10 jobs and increase the value to the crop here. In closing, you know, canola fills a niche in the Willamette Valley, as you heard Kathy Hadley say, dry land rotation, it benefits the grass and wheat crops here. I'd like to encourage you to keep this 500 acres of canola whole until the study's complete. I think we're going to find that these crops are all the same, which we knew all along. But at that point, ODA or the legislature can make a decision to do something different or nothing at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, my name is Anna Scharf, and I'm here today on behalf of Scharf Farms. We have a farm out in Perrydale, Oregon, and we are urging you to vote yes on House Bill 3382. I'm here to share with you today just some of the economic values of canola to family farms. For crop years 2014, Scharf Farms grew 118 acres of certified black leg free canola under the ODA and OSU administered program. That year, we also grew 143 acres of certified but not certified blackleg free radish seed. The radish seed was contracted privately with a seed company. Both were rotational crops to our normal grass, wheat, and clover. Canola is a commodity crop, and it's traded on the market similar to soybeans and wheat. Our farmers here determine when to sell based on the current market price and their individual needs for cash flow. At the time of harvest in 2014, the market prices were very favorable, so we harvested the canola and immediately delivered it from the field to Thomas and received payment in 30 days. The radish we grew, however, is a different story to tell. We harvested and delivered the radish immediately per the terms of the contract, but the radish was a proprietary crop owned by the seed company, and payment for that crop to date has yet to be received. The payment terms per the contract were the first contract payment due was April 15th, but again, we have not received anything, and we are not alone. As of today, Scharf Farms, along with 31 other family-owned farms, has filed crop liens with the Secretary of State's office totaling over $4.5 million for the radish seed grown for this single company. Our next step will be to file a lawsuit to foreclose the grain producer's lien in order to exercise our rights and proceed with payment collection. We are spending money on attorney's fees in order to get paid for a crop that we grew under a contract. The crop that we have already paid for in the way of labor, harvest, fertilizer costs, etc. And cash flow from that crop that we don't have to use to pay for this year's crop expenses. Cash flow in farming is extremely important, especially during harvest. This is the time of the year when the farm inputs are the greatest, labor, fuel, etc. The ability to harvest and sell a crop immediately or when needed is a valuable tool for us to have. Other rotational crops that we grow are also proprietary, radish, grass, clover, row crops, etc., and have payment terms that are tied to when the contracting company wants the product, usually several months after the production of that and the harvest. And payment terms negotiating the contract are awfully difficult to change, if not impossible. From a purely economic standpoint, House Bill 3382 would allow for family farms to have up to 500 acres for the additional 4 to 6 years. It should be noted that in the Oregon State University study, it does not cover the economic value of this crop. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Scott Setnicker. I graduated from Oregon State in 2005 with a crop science degree. I currently am an owner-operator of our family farm located in Independence. We employ about 25 full-time employees, and our farm currently consists of 15 different crops spread over about 5,500 acres, mostly irrigated production, some dry land. Some of the crops we grow currently, some of the big-name crops, we have hazelnuts, peppermint, grass seed, green beans for the cannery. Canola is a crop I grow in the rotation. Wheat, corn for grain. As well as several specialty vegetable seed crops. I currently right now have a field of kale, chard, spinach, red radish, and white radish, which I'm contracted with one of the opponents of this bill, one of his companies. I feel like all of us in this room, all the farmers that are here, we're all seed growers. Just because I grow canola doesn't mean I'm not a seed grower. It just fits into the matrix of my farm. Farming's a really nuanced profession. You know, there's a lot of different factors that go into it. And like Anna said, cash flow is important. So I'm going to have a portion of my production in a crop that I can cash flow. I may have vegetable seed in production too, but I have to have a balance. It all has to fit together. And one other thing that I like about the canola, it's a less risky crop. So when I grow a contracted seed crop, there's a lot of factors that go into it. Seed purity. So all of a sudden I have a weed issue out there. Something comes up, I can't spray it. A lot of the specialty seed crops, there's not a lot of herbicides I can put on there other than sending a crew out there. So if my purity isn't up to standard, I can grow the crop, harvest it, but it can't even be sold to the marketplace. Whereas canola, there's always some value to it. There's more tools in the toolbox to control different pests and diseases. So that factors into my planning on my farm. I have to have a little bit of a risk balance there. So I can grow some of my specialty seed on some acreage, but I can't have all my eggs in that one basket. And that's where the canola kind of fits in my operation. I guess why I want to grow canola. Last year I had a field of canola on a dryland field. It had been in annual ryegrass production for pretty much forever prior to it. Annual ryegrass, I usually would get about 2,000 pounds per acre, and I would make this last season I'm getting about 24 cents. So basically about $500 per acre gross. So you figure out your land rent, your fertilizer, your fuel, the margins are really thin on that. My canola field, right next to my ryegrass field, same field split in half, I'm going to go over $1,000 per acre gross. So yeah, it's not a seed crop, but I'm going to make $600 to $700 per acre more on that production. So that's one reason. The other thing that's been said here is we don't want to grow the GMO canola. We're growing the non-GMO hybrid varieties. Why are we growing those? Because they're yielding better. They've been proven over the years we've grown a little bit of canola here. Those are the varieties that yield. And also, another thing that hasn't been stated today, the non-GMO varieties, we actually get paid about a 2 cent per pound premium for the non-GMO varieties. And so the more canola we're allowed to grow, I think that price is potentially going to come up. We're kind of going to have a niche market for the canola here. Coexistence is key. Coexistence is in place in several crops that were grown in the Willamette Valley already. On my farm, I grow, I grow chard, which chard and sugar beets are pretty much the same plant. So in order to grow chard in my farm here in Independence, it has to fit on around the sugar beets. Well, I couldn't get it on my farm in Independence. I have sugar beets that are being grown next door to me. So I'm growing my chard on my farm up in McMinnville because there's none around. So there's a coexistence system that is in place. With corn, for example, processed corn for this cannery has to be isolated with field corn that's grown for cattle. Even if it's non-GMO, the different types of corn can cross-pollinate and ruin the crop of sweet corn and or the field corn. So coexistence is so important. And I feel like this bill is just, it's a compromise. We're not asking for much. As stated, there's been tens of thousands of acres of radish and turnips grown with no limits on them. The diseases and pests are similar. I've grown all of those crops. I know for a fact that the disease and pests are similar. Why are we picking out canola? You know, I mean, in my rotation for me, it's taking market away from me. You know, we hear about how potentially canola is going to take markets from the Japanese guy, is going to pull his seed production, and Nick's company is going to lose money. Well, right now, I'm going to lose money if this bill doesn't pass. My market's being taken. Because I'm currently growing 100 acres per year of canola. So, and then that factor needs to be factored in too. We're really concerned about the perceived harm of canola. But currently, growers that want to grow canola are in harm now because we're being restricted. Like I stated, I think this is a very moderate request. And I feel like the moratorium that's in place right now is market-based. The seed companies that testified here directly benefit from the moratorium that's in place because they can go to their end users and say, we're in a canola-free valley. Italy, they have canola. Come here. Grow it here. Because I can chart my product is going to be better. And why do you think they're fighting so hard to keep canola out? Because it gives them a market benefit. And is that fair to us growers who want to grow canola? I don't think it's fair. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for the panelists?
Yes.
Yep. Senator.
You'd mentioned that turnips and canola are twins. Now, I was I have turnip farms all around me, and I was told that you as a layman cannot tell the difference between a turnip and a canola unless you pull it out of the ground. Is that true?
I believe that's true, yes.
Okay. And then follow up. Sir, thank you for your testimony. You grow radish and you grow canola.
I actually grow two types of radish. We grow white radish and red radish. Red radish is like a vegetable bulb radish, whereas a white radish is more of a broadacre crop. And there's several markets for radish, but my radish that's going to be my white radish is going as a sprouting radish to Japan. But there's also tillage radish, which can be grown and planted as a cover crop seed. But yes, I grow all three.
And you sell those that seed?
Yes.
Okay. So why are you not concerned with cross-pollination of canola to your crops when it's your fields?
Why am I not concerned? Because I don't feel that it is a major concern. I'm working amongst the plan that's in place. I mean, there's isolations established for all the different crops. Canola isn't necessarily going to affect my radish field. Timings of the bloom is different. Yes, there might be a little bit more disease pressure around because of that field, but it would be no different than if I planted a field of turnips in the exact same location.
Hello? Are there areas now, I mean, you have a 500-acre limit. Are there areas that you could add this extra 500 acres and still remain in this concentrated area?
Well, we're really not adding acres because the years prior that there's a three-year where there will be no production allowed. So the acreage that's being produced currently from last year, this year, and next year, it's going to just exist, you know, moving forward. And as Carol stated when she testified in the House, potentially some of the acreage will probably return back to some, like I'll probably plant canola back on a field I grew the first year of the study, maybe three or four years down the road potentially. So
if the canola ban comes into effect, how does that affect your business?
Well, as I mentioned, Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, as I mentioned, we process a number of different crops. We process soybeans, canola, camelina, and flax. Although we are limited in what we can get into our plant because we can't necessarily import, we don't import canola because it's not economic for us. And some of those other crops, we can go a little bit further, but it prevents us from getting to our maximum capacity in our plant or from expanding our production beyond where we are today. I mean, we are a business in business for profit. We, you know, the market is there. Canola meal is used by every dairy in the state, every dairy in the West Coast, other meals too. But it's a question of maxing out our current facility and then expanding if we have that opportunity.
Thank you. One more, if you don't mind. Ma'am, you grow canola along with other seed crops? And you have no concern over it?
Chairman Edwards and Senator Olson, we do. We grow both of those. We grew canola in 2014, and it was not far from our radish fields. We've also grown radish fields where we had to have isolation agreements. I think you heard another panelist talk about an isolation agreement, which is where the two companies, not the two farmers, settle on an agreement that they are willing to grow closer together than is recommended. And we have absolutely no worries about that. Our canola field is probably one of the best-looking grass fields this year that we've had in a really long time because of the canola production that was done in it in 2014.
When you have, obviously, there's several farms together and nearby. Mm-hmm. I assume that, or I might be false in this, but do you work it out with the other farmers as to what you're going to plant in your fields so that they can also be selective as what they get near your crops?
That's the beauty of farming and coexistence. I'm not the farmer in the room. I'm the business person who came from the business world of farming, so I've had to learn what all that means. One of my neighbors is actually sitting in the back of the room, and I believe will testify later. And we do that. That's part of what you do with farming. If they are pinned commodity crops through proprietary crops through the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, those agreements are worked out by the contracting company, not necessarily by the farmer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Endicott, thanks for giving us that information about the investment that you have. So how much of that investment was due solely to the canola? And the reason I ask that is, you know, here you're facing a situation where in 6 years this could go away forever. I mean, in 3 years this could go away forever. That seems like a pretty risky proposition.
So when we began our business in 2008, we saw canola as an opportunity, for sure, and we've continued to pursue that. But in the interim, we've certainly had to change our business plan to focus on some of those other crops in larger volumes because we couldn't source that volume of canola. So from our perspective, though, it's not as much about we will process whatever we can get. I think the issue is more about the growers having that rotation option. And if they want to grow that crop as a rotation option, they have to have a market to send it to. We are that market for whatever volume of canola would be produced in the Willamette Valley.
Okay. Thank you each. A lot of discussion about whether or not these are market-based decisions, and it's clear to me that there are markets on either side that either want or oppose this bill. So that's what makes it tough. We are calling Dr. Mallory Smith, and then we will go to Cindy Ocombe. I don't know if I pronounced that right.
Hello?
Hello, Dr. Mallory Smith. This is Chris Edwards, State Senator, Chair of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And you are live.
I'm live. Okay, I've been watching you, actually.
And you're testifying right now, so go for it.
Okay. So I know I've put in written testimony, and I don't know if the committee has had time
Before you proceed, could you state your name for the record?
Yes, this is Dr. Carol Mallory Smith. I'm a professor at Oregon State University in the Department of Crop and Soil Science.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, so would you like me to read my testimony, or have you read it?
Oh, man, you're totally calling me out right now. I felt myself just start to sweat, like, oh, do I tell her the truth? I have not read it yet.
But why don't I read it, and then if you have questions, we could talk about it.
Briefly, I haven't looked at it yet, so I don't know if you're talking about reading 20 pages word for word, you're talking about a one-page executive summary.
It's pretty much of a summary.
Okay, go for it.
I'm really sorry that I couldn't be there for today's hearing. I'm in Washington, D.C. One of the things I'd like to make a statement about in the beginning is that Oregon State University doesn't have a position on this bill. We neither support nor oppose this bill. But I wanted to just provide an update on the research that's been discussed as I was watching this that was started in response to the H bill. The House Bill 2427. And one of the objectives of that research was to monitor those 500 acres of canola that are being allowed to be planted each year, so it's 1,500 acres in the end. And we are monitoring those fields for diseases, insects, and also for volunteer crop plants that occur in subsequent years. In addition to the canola fields, approximately 500 acres each of radish and turnip are being monitored, and they're being monitored for some of the reasons that were already brought up in some of the testimony, is that these species are widely grown, and they would be a good expectation that they could have similar pest diseases or volunteer issues. So in 2013, we planted the fields. They were monitored. Those fields, as was mentioned before, were actually planted with FOMA disease-free seed that had been treated with fungicides before planting. None of the fields were genetically engineered canola, so there was no GMO canola out there. And at crop emergence and shortly after, we started monitoring those fields. We have not seen any differences in the insect tests among canola, turnip, or radish. Then in the spring, though, of 2014, we did identify blackleg in the fields, but those were found in multiple different species of grasses, including canola, turnip, forage rape, vegetable seed crops, and included both conventional and organic production. And we also identified the disease on weed species. There's no evidence from what we've seen so far that the canola was actually related to that disease outbreak. It's not, that particular disease is not unique to canola, but it's an industry-wide problem. Blackleg's been present in the Willamette Valley for many years and has been detected previously by the Oregon Department of Agriculture when it's been doing field inspections. However, the incidence of blackleg was much greater in this past 2 years than it was in recent years. We've also identified some other diseases in those fields, but again, they're not specific to canola. They go across the brassica crops, of which canola is one. In 2014, we've had the fields have been planted again, and we started monitoring in 2015. We saw volunteers in all of the different crops that we were following, especially in the canola, turnip, and radish. We saw volunteers. Growers have been controlling those. There's still some volunteers around. If you drive around, you're going to see some fields with different either yellow or white flowered. So they're either going to be turnip or radish probably on the roadside, along with some native species that are out there. So not everything that we're seeing are actually volunteers along the roadside. So we really feel that this increased monitoring that resulted from this state-funded research identified this problem earlier than it otherwise would have been, and that we believe that the work we've conducted to date has been beneficial to all brassica crop growers. We've tried to inform all growers about the issues that they're facing and made recommendations on how to control the diseases in and also working with people to make sure that those volunteer plants are controlled, and we need to have those controlled specifically so that we don't have inoculum of those diseases building up in the Willamette Valley. We are working with the Department of Agriculture to provide them information on the diseases that we're finding. And I would just like to reiterate, to date, the research has not identified any characteristics of canola that make it uniquely different than any other brassica species in regards to diseases or pests. However, we're 18 months into this research. We have not completed it. I don't expect that those results will change, but I can't say that that something couldn't change over time.
Okay.
So if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Doctor. Senator Denbrough.
Hello, Dr. Mallory Smith. Thank you for making yourself available. Hope the weather is nice out there in D.C.
It's 90 degrees.
And humid.
Okay. Better you there than me. Thank you. So, you mentioned that one of the purposes of this study is to look at, disease and pest presence. There were other purposes of the study, though, as well, right? And what are those, and how are those aspects going?
Okay, Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough. There were three objectives to this research. The first one was to do a complete, thorough literature search to make sure that we, just go back and look at a lot of the literature that's out there. And the third objective is to work on finding a way of mapping the Willamette Valley and actually determining how much area could be planted to brassica crops. And that's ongoing.
And then you said there were three objectives, you said?
Three objectives. So the one that we've been talking about was the second objective of this research. Mm-hmm. It's the one that is really the farthest along and has the most information or the most data.
And the third objective was?
Was to look at the mapping the Willamette Valley and determining how many acres of brassica could actually be grown in the Willamette Valley and still be able to maintain the isolation distances.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, ultimately the study is going to lead to a recommendation, no? Is that where you're headed, making a recommendation as to whether or not canola can be safely grown in the valley?
Chair, Senator Denbrough, I don't know that there will be a final recommendation, but the data will be scientifically presented so that people can make decisions based on that data. I think that decision is probably going to be back in somebody's lap there at the legislature in a few years, but at least the information will be there to make those decisions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Przanski.
Thank you. Doctor, I'm wondering if you could tell us, based on your testimony, it sounds like you're kind of leaning in a direction as to what you think the conclusion is, but you said over time things could change. When would you feel that you would be in a definitive position to say what you think the outcome will be?
Chair Edwards and Senator Propatsky, you know, when at the end of this 3 years of this research, we're going to have, you know, we will have gathered the data that we'll have, and then there's some monitoring that's to go on after the end of the 3 years as Oregon State University sees it feasible to do. I think even at the end of that 3 years, there's going to be a decision to be made. And because it goes back to many of the things that have been already been testified to today.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. I have just read your testimony that you provided, and
I did too.
It was fair for me to be able to read it. But, Doctor, I know you. It's impossible for you to reach conclusions at this time, but do you think there would be a problem with a continuation of growing canola from what you've testified to today?
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, as I said, there's nothing unique about canola. And so because it has the same pests and diseases that especially turnip have, but some of the other even vegetable seed crops and fresh vegetables, I don't see that that 500 acres is going to change the outcome of this study.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
Do you find or do you not find that canola is a more lucrative carrier of these problems that you have, or is it just as equivalent to the other seeds that are used? If you understand what I'm saying.
Yes, I understand. I don't know. I'm thinking that Dr. Oakham is there to testify today.
Yeah, she'll be up next.
Okay, so she could answer some of those questions for you in detail. I would say, from what we've seen, though, in the field, that there's not, especially between turnip and canola and some of the specialty seed crops, they're all susceptible. It's an industry-wide problem.
Thank you, and one follow-up question. Since canola seems to be such a lucrative crop, is it not beneficial for farmers to examine the opportunity to use it and use it in conjunction with other seed crops they grow?
As one of the other people who testified said, you know, we haven't really run the economic part of this. It's good for growers to have a rotational crop. That's sort of agronomy 101. We always say having a rotational crop in your system is good, but the economics comes back to what a grower sees on his or her own farm. And so it's really hard to say, or for somebody to say this isn't economic for this person to grow. That's a decision that each grower should be making.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mallory Smith. I think that's it for questions from our committee. We appreciate you being available by telephone while you're on your travels.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Safe travels.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Next up, we are going to go to the aforementioned Dr. Cindy Oakham. And then after that, and folks, we are the clock is marching on, so after that, we have 7 people afterwards. So we're getting down to about 3 per, but we do have one of the professors that is working on the study, so I think we should allow a little bit more time for some questions. So go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair Edwards. My name is Cynthia Oakham. I'm an OSU faculty member in the Botany and Plant Pathology Department. I have an appointment as an extension plant pathologist. I've been working in the state of Oregon for almost 18 years on vegetables, including the brassica crops. And I first want to say that I have no opinion on the change of acreage in this bill as a OSU member, but I wanted to come here so that I could address this burning issue of diseases in canola and the other crucifer crops. And blackleg, an important fungal disease, is widespread in the Willamette Valley on all types of crucifer crops at this time. The problem analysis for this disease is too complex to distill in 3 minutes, so I provided a one-page write-up with also a second page of pictures so that you can just see some of the damage that we're finding in the fields. And I would say generally a decrease in the crucifer acreage with blackleg is probably more important in my pathology opinion than increases or decreases in crucifer acreages overall. Unless the valley is overly saturated with crucifers, in which case a reduction in total crucifer acreage would be beneficial. Requiring disease management in canola so that severe blackleg outbreaks are prevented would improve the cohabitation of oilseed canola with the specialty crucifer seed crops. But since blackleg outbreaks are occurring in other crucifer crops, having requirements only for canola would be unfair. And just for your note, the Department of Ag is undergoing some hearings on having mandatory field inspections for all of these susceptible crops. And then finally, regardless of your decision, I also wanted to ask that you would please leave untouched the disease management regulations that the ODA has put into place for replacing the seed treatment rules that were struck out on the last bill when the 2427, I believe, came in. And so if you could just make sure to leave those disease management protections in place for the crucifers planted in the Willamette Valley Protection District, that's one thing that I wanted to bring to your attention to. And that's all the testimony I wanted to read. I didn't want to read out my whole thing, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Could you go back over the last thing that you said? Could you say it again? The seed treatment rules?
Yes. I wanted to ask you if you would please leave the ODA disease management regulations. Right now it's OAR 603-052-0870. If you could please leave that regulation or a set of regulations and anything that they develop in the future for crucifers planted in the Willamette Valley Protection District, if you could please leave those regulations untouched.
Okay.
Or replace them with complete set.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Wow, I thought we'd have more questions, so I guess.
And my contact information is at the top of the handout, so if you do have questions later, I'd be delighted to try and answer those.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. We'll give you a call if we have any other questions. So.
Okay, thanks.
Which we may. Okay, next up we're going to go with Jerome Rosa, Barry Bouchou, and Eric Bowers. And then after that will be Roger Beyer, Matt Crawford, and Joseph Sherman. And after that will be Ivan Molesky. Go ahead, any of you.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Jerome Rosa. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I'm here today to support House Bill 3382. Protein sources for the beef and dairy industries are currently nearly non-existent in the Willamette Valley. Soybean meal, distiller's grain, sunflower and safflower meal are all brought in mainly from the Midwest. Canola meal and flaxseed meal are brought in mainly from Canada. Fish meal at over $1 a pound is not economically feasible for our producers to feed for over 7 to 8 years now. Thousands of tons of canola meal come into dairies and into cattle feedlots every year in the Willamette Valley already and have for many, many years. Our consumers and producers are now demanding local, sustainable food and feed sources for our cattle. With many brassicas currently being allowed to be grown in the Willamette Valley, it's not fair to just allow increased, to not allow increased canola production. House Bill 3382 amends the law, extending the sunset prohibiting the growing of canola in most of the Willamette Valley, authorizing up to 500 acres for commercial production of canola. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Chairman Edwards, committee, I'd ask for your support for this bill. I'm Eric Bowers, Harrisburg, Oregon, grass seed grower, grow a little bit of wheat and some Metafoam, and one of my rotations was, which really wasn't a rotation for years, was field burning, and that's how I grew a lot of pure grass seed without a lot of problems, and eliminated breeding up resistant grasses because you were burning the wheat seeds instead of using herbicides. So with the rotation, you know, you got to understand, in the South Valley, I farm in Linn and Lane County both. And in South Valley, we have a lot of wet soils. Okay, so Metafoam is one of my rotations I can use. But it's kind of a, it's kind of like a lot of these vegetable seeds we're talking about. There's not a huge market for it, so you're just talking a few acres. And a lot of my fields are big fields. And even though the canola would not grow good on several of my acres, it would grow on the same acres that my wheat would grow on, which then I could break the cycle of diseases in my wheat. Plus, I could also go there with grass and not have a, have the problems I have with the resistant weeds that I've created over the last 10 years or so. And so I guess I would ask for you to vote yes on this, just because I'm for freedom, and I'm also for success of my neighbors. But I have a feeling that some of my neighbors are not for the success of me, and the success of me, I need some rotations. And a canola would come in real handy in this situation. The vegetable seeds, another thing about the vegetable seeds is they're grown on small acreage. We're talking, I mean, there's some of these crops, 1 or 2 acres up to 50. The radishes and turnips are on bigger acreage. But like one of the growers said earlier, the radishes, I've experimented with radishes a little bit on some of my better soils. And I think I've been paid partially for my 13 crop, my 14 crop. I don't know when I'll be paid for that, because they don't use it until they use it, and we kind of got an agreement work out. So I can't have a lot of acres of those kind of crops. I need crops that I can get a check for when I sell them. And so then that's another reason canola would come in. You could plant it in bigger acreage. And I have no problem with keeping it 3 miles away from somebody else's vegetable seeds. That's, you know, I mean, that's, like I said, I grow fescue right up against my neighbor's fescue. I grow ryegrasses up against my neighbor's ryegrass, and we all take care of it. You know, we have to stake it off to Oregon State to fly over with their helicopter here in a couple weeks and make sure. And then we cut it separate and clean it separate and all that good stuff. So I think 500 acres is a drop in the bucket in the Willamette Valley, and I don't think it would hurt to continue it for 3 more years. Thank you.
Chair Edwards, member of the committee, my name is Barry Bashu. I'm the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation here, and here today to represent them. There's been a lot of talk recently here this morning or this afternoon about the compromising commitment of House Bill 2427. I wanted to clarify the record that the Farm Bureau did not support that bill. Science and data are always good. We particularly appreciate the work of Dr. Carol Mallory Smith and the other person that was here just a minute ago. And but the reality is that the unfortunate result of 2427 is that it was a bill that protected one market over another. It was a market-driven bill. It was not a science-driven bill. I don't have the luxury of representing a specific crop. Oregon Farm Bureau believes in and is particularly proud of the diversity of Oregon's agriculture. That has been achieved by the addition of new crops, new technologies, and the willingness of farmers to work together and their own neighbors, as has been testified to numerous people here today. With respect to the legislature and the challenges that you all face in making public policy decisions, we really don't believe that the legislature should be called upon to choose between farmers and crop type whenever there are farmers who believe their crop or farm is more important than that of their neighbors. Our policy opposes the banning of legal crops and feels that decisions are best made by the growers with help from Oregon Department of Agriculture or OSU when requested. coexistence works and will continue to do so. I urge you to move this bill. I feel it is still very restrictive, but it does allow those 500 acres to continue. It does not increase the acreage. It does not lift any restrictions, and I feel it warrants your support and would appreciate you moving this bill on. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Senator Olson.
Mr. Bowers, if the 500 acres of canola is already aggregated out there and they're growing it, how would you get into the mix?
Well, I guess I feel like canola has been proven guilty before, or it's guilty before it can be proven innocent. Maybe that's why I should say that. But I think eventually we're going to find out there isn't a problem. And then hopefully in after the 3 years, we can go to 5,000 acres in the valley. And that's I guess, I'm just kind of going that direction and supporting it as a future crop for me on these larger acreages. So I guess that's where I'm looking at. And I'm always looking for another crop to grow for a rotation, and you got to start somewhere.
Hello. Yeah, crop rotation in farming is critical.
Yes.
It's just like in my little garden. Put the tomatoes in the same place all the time. Doesn't work so good.
No.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Okay. Questions for the panelists?
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you each for being here. Roger Beyer, Matt Crawford, and Joseph Sherman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. You have received my testimony, and it's up in OLIS, so I won't read it. Just here to reiterate, I guess, the dairy farmers use canola meal as a valuable protein source. If it can be sourced locally, it's cheaper. Oregon dairy farmers are subject to, they do not set their own prices. They have to, they're at the mercy of the pricing regionally, so a local source of meal is very valuable to them as they can avoid shipment costs. With that, Mr. Chair, again, my testimony is up in writing. Actually, it's signed by Tammy Kerr, the Executive Director of the Dairy Farmers Association. Be happy to answer any questions. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
We'll get through everybody, then come back to you. I have a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Matt Crawford. I have a 1,000-acre farm roughly 15 miles west of Salem. And last year, my farm was a recipient of the Polk County Soil and Water Conservationist of the Year Award. I am in support of House Bill 3382. The option to grow canola in the Willamette Valley would be a great tool for solving multiple problems we are facing today. Resistance issues are now starting to inflict serious financial damage in the valley, in the valley's grass seed and cereal grain industries. Resistant strains of annual ryegrass and poa annua are infecting more and more acres. This comes from repeated use of the same herbicides over the last 20 years. If we do not find a way to ease our reliance on this same type of chemistry, we may quickly destroy the grass seed industry that so many of us have worked hard to build. Canola would give us a strong tool agronomically and financially to combat the spread of the new super weeds we are now facing. Not only will canola open new options to fight these weeds, soil health would be greatly boosted as well. It will only be a matter of time before we will face not only resistant weeds, but pests and diseases as well. We have already seen a dramatic increase in soil health the years after growing a canola crop. As farmers, we need to have 20 to 30% of our acreage in a financially viable rotation crops each year to maintain good soil health and good agronomic stewardship. The current specialty seed industry does not allow for this due to the small acreage available for contract and the isolation distances required. I would hope that all involved in agriculture in the valley could come together and look toward the future to try to solve this problem. I strongly urge you to pass House Bill 3382. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Go ahead.
Chairman Edwards and the committee, my name is Joseph Sherman. I own and operate a third-generation family farm in Sublimity. I'm in favor of the bill. Currently on my farm, we've been involved with the Oregon State canola study. I mean, we've grown it for 2 years now. This is the second year. The little bit I know about it is last year we grew it. We yielded 4,200 pounds. To us, that was a phenomenal yield. And if there was a concern for the, you know, what happens after you harvest it, what happens with the seed, it would surely show up this year. And we rotated into perennial ryegrass, and I can't find one canola plant. And we've done our routine sprays throughout the winter and spring, and it's turned into a beautiful field of perennial ryegrass for us. We also grow a forage brassica crop that's contracted for seed, and we grew it 4 years ago. We worked it up. We harvested it, and we worked it after we harvested it. We planted it to ryegrass. It was in there for 3 years. We worked it out of ryegrass, and we let it lay. It rained in the fall, and it was unbelievably solid of that forage brassica. So we learned that that particular crop, which is it's like a twin of the canola, it stayed in the soil after working it after a crop for 3 years of perennial ryegrass. So I'm not sure where this worry of canola is going to create, you know, all this problems with what happens in the future after you grow it, you know. And with the seed that we've grown from the brassica, you know, we haven't had any crossing with the canola or the seed quality being bad. So that's kind of what I'm dealing with on my farm. We're 100% dry land, so I'm always looking for tools on what I can do to make the crops that I grow. You know, I'm predominantly grass seed, and I see canola as a good, you know, tool to help it improve it and keep it sustainable. So thank you for letting me speak.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. Questions of the panelists? Yes, Senator Prasansky.
Roger, I know that you represent a lot of different people. Has the Oregon Seed Council taken a position on this yet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Prasansky. The Oregon Seed Council has taken no position on this bill.
Thank you.
Roger, the canola, the canola meal, is that generally used? Where are your farmers located that generally use this?
Mr. Chair, the dairy farmers are scattered all over the state of Oregon. So you've got the farmers in the eastern part of the state obviously are sourcing their canola from other sources, not in the valley. The canola that would be grown in the valley, the dairy farmers in the dairy farmers in the Salem area, the Eugene area, the northern valley, Clackamas County, would all be available. That'd be available protein source for all of them.
Okay.
You know, the closer they are to the facility, the cheaper the shipping costs. So.
Sure. Okay. So you can't really afford to ship it that far as dairy feed.
Well, Mr. Chair, the farmers are bringing in canola meal now from a long ways, but it really adds to the cost of it. So a local source would be beneficial financially to them, even a small amount. It's a very valuable protein source.
Okay. And it is a relatively small amount. I mean, the 500 acres worth, I'm assuming that's a relatively small amount, yet valuable, and would certainly like to see more of it for your farmers.
Yes, Mr. Chair. As we heard, if it was 4,200 pounds per acre at 500 acres, that's a couple million pounds of seed. Fairly small amount, but very valuable source.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator. Mr. Beyer, I know you mentioned this to me earlier, but I'd like to get it on the record. Could you explain when they feed the canola what the impact is on the production?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I believe someone earlier today made that testimony. I had not heard that number before. I think they said it was increased the yield of milk by 1 liter per cow per day, as was, if I recall correctly, someone said that. I would have to verify that. I don't have that information in front of me.
Yeah, follow up.
Yeah,
follow up. But that really improves the bottom line of a dairy farmer, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, a liter of milk. I think a cow is capable of producing. I need to check, but I think maybe 100 pounds of milk per day. A liter would probably be about a pound.
Oh.
So
you get an extra pound. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions of the panelists?
Thank you.
And final person that signed up, Ivan Molesky. Not the final person to sign up, but the final person to be called. Actually, we're the final person to sign up, coincidentally.
Got here a little late. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. We worked extensively on this bill in 2013. We worked very closely then at that time and still do with Willamette Valley specialty seed producers, fresh market vegetable growers, both organic and conventional producers as well, all of whom raised significant concerns about how canola was being managed in the valley at the time. I'll be very brief because I know you're here at the end of the committee, but we oppose House Bill 3382. We believe it will undo carefully crafted legislation from 2013. We call it carefully crafted because the whole intent of it was to build a good baseline of science from which we could make future decisions. And we've even heard folks who were perhaps critical of that legislation praising certain parts of it. So if that's not carefully crafted, I don't know what is. One of the things that I'd like to flag of why we think this is of concern to us is these 500 acres per year are going to be coming right at the time they're outside the normal study that was authorized by 2427. HB 2427 had 3 years of 500 acres of study each and then 3 years for monitoring because it's well known that canola seed can stay in the soil for quite a long time and can reemerge years after. And so that monitoring period was very critical. And ultimately, to underscore some of this conflict in the bill, the bill authorizes commercial canola production to begin after July 1st, 2016, while 2013's bill directed OSU to provide its final research report results in 2017. So you're not even going to have the final results in before you start authorizing commercial production. If those acres end up being some of the same acres, we believe it actually will impact the results of the study, and I'm not sure exactly how folks are suggesting it won't. And that's not only contrary to the intent of the law, but also I think the spirit to try to get good data on the ground that we could use to make future decisions. Further, the bill explicit 2033-82 explicitly allows unlimited canola planting beginning in 2019 without any sort of state oversight or required coexistence. So essentially, you're going to get that unrestricted free-for-all that some folks raised a concern about who are canola growers 29 or after if you don't amend this bill to address that serious deficiency. We've got significant industries that are at stake. You've heard testimony earlier about the value of the specialty seed industry, the number of farmers involved. Ultimately, it's our belief as well that the issue of genetically engineered canola has not been talked about a lot, but we heard one farmer just at the panel before me talk about the issue of herbicide resistance spreading in the valley. We're very pleased that the handful of growers that are currently growing canola are voluntarily not growing genetically engineered canola. But unless you make this a requirement, there's no telling that if we start to go up to 3,000 acres, 5,000 acres, 10,000 acres, or whatever the end game is, if you don't have that set in stone at this time, I think we're going to have real problems down the road with herbicide resistant canola in the valley. If you drive up and down the Willamette Valley now, you're going to see wild weedy mustards that are growing all over the valley along roadsides and elsewhere in fields, and you want to make sure that those aren't having herbicide resistant traits spread to them. Lastly, I'll just sort of close by saying that Dr. Mallory Smith suggested that there's nothing unique about canola. One thing I would do is refer you to her paper from 2008, which suggests otherwise, frankly. It's called Gene Flow from Glyphosate-Resistant Crops. It was an Oregon State University paper from 2008, and it has a section on canola which talks how weedy it has become in certain regions of Canada, how it can outcross with similar relatives, how persistent it can be in the seed bank. So there's a wealth of information. Our hope with 2427 is that we were going to look at the literature review, we were going to do the on-the-ground research, we would wait for the results, and then we would take a look based on the science about what's next. So unfortunately, this bill breaks away from that that intent of having good science to make good decisions on, and so that's why we oppose this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that concise summary of your objections. Questions for Ivan? No. So your contention, Ivan, would be that while some folks have said it wouldn't, continuing with 500 acres, continuing with an allotment wouldn't affect the study, but you're pointing out that it could affect the study if, in fact, some of those acres were the same acres that were still in study and awaiting, potential for issues to pop up.
Chair Edwards, there's two ways in which it really impacts study. One, in that case that you just outlined, in which you start to grow canola on acres that you were supposed to be monitoring in the first study, which you weren't initially under the original bill going to be growing canola on. But second, remember that we funded 3 years of research, and now this next 500 acres, these aren't going to be research plots. So really, there's nobody minding the store, if you will, in terms of monitoring. And so you're actually going to see, we're not even going to be able to be watching for the impacts. We already had an issue where we may have needed to come back to the legislature to figure out how are we going to monitor that during that second year of the moratorium. Now we're going to be adding a whole new layer on that is commercial in nature, non-research. So in terms of both the acreage by acreage impacts, yes, but also in terms of muddying what results we're getting during that second 3 years as well.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Ivan?
Just one.
Sir Dimber.
Yeah, I'm still kind of puzzling over the timeline that was put together, around 24, 27. Mm-hmm. And you were involved in that, yeah. So the whole notion of, a three-year study and then a three-year subsequent moratorium, ongoing moratorium, I mean, where did that come from? How did that strategy get developed?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro. So part of it was based on the funding, the reality of trying to fund this kind of research. And so in total, the research is approximately $200,000, $250,000 per year. And what the Ways and Means Committee was able to come up with at the time effectively covered 3 years of research. And it said, we will monitor during the next 3 years to the extent practicable. If we could have funded 6 years of research, I think that would have been preferable. But ultimately, one of the well-known issues with canola, despite what some folks have testified to today, is its persistence in the seed bank. That 2000 paper I mentioned from Dr. Mallory Smith talks about 5 to 7 years potentially in some cases for, and we're talking millions of seeds scattering. We're talking about situations where if a storm event happens, you've got seed that can actually leave site, end up in irrigation ditches, moving downstream and sprouting elsewhere where it wasn't intended. So the whole point of the second 3 years was to have no commercial production while we actually monitor to see what was happening during those first 3 years. If we could have funded that second 3 years of monitoring, that would have been preferable. We weren't able to during the Ways and Means process. But that was really the intent, to have a period where we would grow it and then we would watch it, because the seed bank persistence issue is so significant.
And follow up. And when were you thinking that this would come back to the legislature for action? Was that talked about?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, I was assuming that we would probably come back to talk about this perhaps as early as 2017 when the research results had come in. That's the deadline is in the fall of 2017 when OSU had to publish. That doesn't mean they couldn't have published some earlier in the spring, but perhaps 2018 or 2019. So we were assuming that it would be in that second three-year window when we would start to have the research published. We would be in the monitoring phase of those ongoing fields, but we could start to have a conversation. With this bill, essentially what it says is there is no cap on acreage during the second half of 2019. So unless the legislature is willing to come back again, fix this now, come back in 2017 again, or come back in 2019 again, it really is going to be a free-for-all come 2019, the way that this bill is currently written.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yeah. You kind of piqued my interest a little bit when you talked about the canola seed going downstream and all that. But wouldn't that be typical of any brassicas? Couldn't radishes, white and red, that we just learned about, or turnips, run downstream and volunteer someplace else and cause a problem?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, it's possible that some brassica seeds that are on the ground at a time of a big rain event could travel off site, for sure. One of the things why we flagged the issue that there's no prohibition on herbicide resistant canola is that if you have that start to happen with canola, that's a very unique situation to canola that isn't common to any other brassicas. There are no other brassicas that have herbicide resistant traits engineered into them. So again, while we appreciate that voluntarily the handful of growers who are doing it now are doing it non-genetically engineered, that's certainly not necessarily the case in the future, and so presents a unique risk with that type of canola in particular.
Follow up?
Yeah.
But there is a possibility that someone's white radish could impact somebody's red radish 5 miles down the road. But you don't mention that. You don't talk about that consideration,
considering the fact that these are all in the same family.
Well, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, actually, the 2427 bill, this is part of why it was what we believe a compromise and carefully crafted, because some of those issues were raised around radish and turnip, and that's why we're studying those as well. The only change to the 2013 bill that this bill makes is specific to canola. So we wanted to make sure that the concerns about that crop are noted here today for the record.
One last question. Actually, it's more of a comment. I've been on this committee for 5 years. I've seen these battles consistently with different groups of people. My stuff is better than your stuff. It's quite interesting now to see it in crop discussions. We've gotten rid of fishermen, we've gotten rid of gold miners, and we do all of this because mine is better than yours. And I find it quite interesting that this argument of which crop is more valuable, when we have testimony on both sides, farmers doing the exact same thing everybody does, and then we come to find out that this product is competitive, and it sometimes it just sounds like you don't want to get into that game because you could make more money at it. But you grow pure seed, and you want to be able to stay in that market. I can understand controlling your market, but I sometimes have difficulty understanding why an expansion of a market, if it's a good rotation crop, couldn't be beneficial to everybody.
I guess, Senator Enders, our position is we'd like to see the study play out that we agreed to in 2013 and make some decisions based on that. Thank you.
Any other questions, Robbins? Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else that did not sign up that would like to testify on House Bill 3382? Okay, seeing nobody, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3382, and we are adjourned for the day. For the day. Two, and we are adjourned.